Hey everybody, my name is Kate and you are listening to This Australian Life on the CRN. Very excited to be originally broadcasting from Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. Please enjoy. Hello, my name is Kate and welcome to This Australian Life. This week, we have two really special guests, and I'm not just saying that, both quite diverse in their perspective and their stories. I think they have a common theme, this idea of trying as hard as we can to help others, and ultimately, in that way, find ourselves. First off, we have Christy Rohrer, a good friend of mine who is non-binary, who has come today to us to talk a little bit about some of the issues affecting trans and non-binary people. Really pertinent issues like the idea of transitioning at a young age, what it means to have trans men and women in sports, and much, much more. Secondly, with Morgan, we're going to be talking about her life as an ambulance driver. Morgan is cisgendered female, and she'll talk about really interesting issues, things you might expect, like violence against ambulance workers, but also some things you might not have realized. What it's like to have the effects of shift work on your schedule in an industry that is largely 24 hours. I hope you enjoy. As always, if you have any comments, feel free to shoot me an email. I'm still waiting at thisaustralianlife@joy.org.au.
So my full name's Christy Raw. I am 36. And my gender, I'm non-binary. I use they, them pronouns. Sometimes I like to experiment with he, him. Some days I want to wake up and fully transition, but at the moment, it's a gender. I like to be called by my last name because it makes me feel like a jock on a football field, and I like that feeling.
People in your life do resist being told to call you something differently, to see you differently.
There's this one person in particular that I'm thinking of, and they've always been extremely close to me. They've been my best friend for like 10 years. So they were the last person that I expected to encounter resistance from. And they've had really, really big problems as I've come out to them with what that means.
Can you start just by giving me some really specific examples of instances you've had, like things that somebody said to you?
Oh, God, I can't remember the very start of it, but it was, you'll always be my lesbian friend. It was that. And which was really funny to me because I'm like, I've never even identified as a lesbian. I've always been quite, I've always been bisexual or pansexual or bi plus. Like, I've always identified as that. So it was a really interesting comment, but that was by one of the people who were closest to me. And yeah, her resistance against seeing that or even entertaining that possibility. And yeah, God, that really hurt at the time. Because I'm like, well, that's not even accurate. Like, but, you know, I've just... it is actually her stuff. It's not actually me. And then there's people in my life who, like yourself, who have just always taken me for who I am and accepted me for who I am and believed me when I tell you who I am, without question. And that kind of support is, that's unquantifiable. That makes the other side, you know, the people who, I guess, you experience a level of resistance or rejection from, makes you able to withstand that.
Are you out with being non-binary with your mom, your dad, your siblings, your kid?
I am with my child, yes. they haven't quite got the pronouns right yet, but I also don't push it because not everyone in my life is using pronouns, so using the correct pronouns for me, because I'm not ready to push that barrel with everyone. So I extend him a little bit of grace, but we have so many conversations around gender and gender identity and deconstructing binary genders and what that means and how these gender roles play out. So it's like, because he's so young and not so indoctrinated into the culture, you know, of gender, then he's able to see the absurdity of it in ways that are really great, and we have really great conversations around that. And so he's really flexible and adaptable, and he's even come to me and said, yeah, sometimes I feel like a boy and a girl. I remember one day, this was probably about a couple of years ago, my mom said to me that my pronouns on Facebook were they and them, and I'm like, yep. And that was it. That was the extent of the conversation. So, I mean, I feel like she should know, but I have this real resistance to, I guess, quote unquote, coming out. I feel like that is such a product of cisnormativity. It is a product of cisnormativity and heteronormativity. And I feel like that burden shouldn't be on me.
Just changing tracks a little bit.
Yeah.
I was interested. I saw this video online. This is a good way to start a question. I saw a video online, and it was a YouTuber something ranting about this trans woman who was talking about how they had dated their partner for a number of years and hadn't come out as trans.
Mm.
And he was very upset.
I think I know this. What you're talking about. Yeah.
And it wasn't so much what he was saying, but I guess how he said it. There was this deep anger and injustice. And you just talked about this idea of the onus not being on the person to identify.
Hmm.
What would you feel about that in terms of a dating situation?
Yeah, I mean, you don't owe it to anyone to tell them you're trans. Like that, I don't think that responsibility is on you. And depending on who you're with, you put yourself in physical danger by doing it. And, you know, I feel for all trans people, and especially I think trans women are particularly vulnerable to this because of the way that toxic masculinity presents itself. And, you know, cis men particularly are so threatened by trans women in ways that it costs trans women their lives. In that, I'm like, what difference does it make to this partner whether his girlfriend is trans or not? It's like, I from my perspective, I can't understand how that makes any difference to him. What does it change? She's the same person you got together with. And the only reason it would bother him is because it's the transphobia of trans women aren't real women. Trans women are men dressed as women.
Sometimes in dating apps or Facebook groups, whatever, I've noticed that some people, especially trans people, from my experience, can have very specific wants in a partner. And one of those is that their partner be trans.
Mm-hmm.
But what you mentioned before when we were talking is that if you're trans, you don't have to have that be apparent or out to somebody.
Mm.
So it sounds like it does matter to some people that they do know if someone is trans or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're probably talking about it from different perspectives, though. I think it does matter for the trans person whether or not you're dating a trans person, and not because you only want to date trans people because that's necessarily who you're only sexually attracted to. But it's so hard for people. There is so much transphobia built into our culture, and you're confronting that everywhere. So, I mean, I know for myself, it's been a while since I've had a romantic relationship, but if I was in one with someone who was trans, it would take at least some elements of that relationship and make it a whole lot easier. And I know in some relationships you feel like you're holding your breath waiting for them to do that thing. you know, that in terms of like the misogyny or transphobia or whatever it is, like just waiting for that moment to hit.
Another tricky question for you.
Please.
I find this all very interesting, but it's also, there's a fine line. I'm sure I could easily cross it where I insult someone. Anyway, when children start transitioning at, say, 13, 14, maybe even they're transitioning younger, I'm not aware. Do you think that brings into account the fact that someone might not be fully formed as an adult and maybe they're making an uninformed decision?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of misinformation around this topic. So I think it's a really good question because I think that people's fears are legitimate, but I also think that the information has been conflated in terms of what actually happens, and what tends to happen at that age is puberty blockers are given so that no changes happen, so that children can have time, so that if those children decide that they still want to go through with HRT or any kind of surgery, it's much easier if they haven't gone through the puberty of the sex that they were assigned at birth. But I think I was reading an academic study, and I'm terrible at remembering detail of things that I've read, but generally children have a very firm sense of their gender at 9 years old. You know, I know for myself, going down the road of HRT now is a very intimidating process, and it's a very difficult decision to make because, you know, I'm also, and I hope I can say this, I'm also in recovery from an eating disorder and trying to understand where my dysmorphia starts and my dysphoria ends is very, very difficult. They're so intertwined because they've had so long together. You know, I'm 36, like I'm not starting this journey back when, you know, before I hit puberty or even through my journey of puberty. You know, I think those interventions at that age can be just so helpful. And they don't have lasting negative impacts, you know. There's a whole group of, I want to call them ex-trans people, but lots of people who have transitioned and later decided that that wasn't actually the right path for them. And even all those people are in support of helping kids now who are trans have access to the things that they need to be able to exist.
Here are some short messages from our sponsors. My name is Kate, and a reminder that you are listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9. Today, we're talking with Christy Rohrer, who identifies as non-binary, sometimes going by he/his pronouns, and who's chatting with us today about some of the issues relating to trans and non-binary rights. I wanted to take this time to also give a quick definition of gender dysphoria, in case you didn't know. Gender dysphoria is when your body doesn't feel in alignment with your gender identity. This is taken from the book Seeing Gender by Iris Gottlieb. Thanks for listening. If you were to, say, start taking testosterone or something more, I don't know if the right language is dramatic, but is that reversible then?
Yeah, so there are some things that change that can't be changed back. And I know, so for example, if I was to go on testosterone, my voice would change, which I would love. I'm always like trying to like naturally deepen my voice, but it's a little bit hard to like always stay there. And I forget, I'm like, oh yeah, go back to it. But that I know is one thing that it is irreversible. So your deepening voice, that is irreversible. You know, obviously your fat distribution and your angles change with, you know, an increase in testosterone. But once you go off testosterone, if, you know, you naturally have a higher level of estrogen and that comes back, then, you know, you'll revert back to sort of those different kind of quote unquote feminine fat distribution, I guess.
Speaking about trans women and men in sports, it's a really touchy subject. What are your thoughts on it?
I think that there are other writers out there that have written really excellent analysis on this, and I really encourage anyone who's interested in this to really thoroughly do your research, because there's some amazing analysis. I'm not coming from this as an expert, but there is such a process that, you know, say for the Olympics, if you're a trans woman, the level of testing you have to go through to make sure your testosterone is at a certain level and your estrogen is at a certain level before you even get to compete, that people thinking that there's an unfair advantage, like, there isn't. So there are already all these processes in place, so I don't really even understand what the problem is about it now. And I mean, how many trans women are competing in the Olympics or competing in sports, or how many trans people do you know in general who are getting to compete at any kind of like competitive level? There are basically none, like so I think this hyperbole around it is just not reflective of actually what's happening. And it's not to say there aren't trans athletes, but it's hard enough just to exist in the world. This is a non-issue. Like, and I think one of the ones that have come up really recently, and I'm trying to think of the competitor, and I think she is she's a runner, I think, and she's intersex, and she identifies as, she uses she, her pronouns. And so discourse at the moment has been flared up again recently around trans people in sport, and it's around her, and she's not even trans. And so it tells me that it's like people don't even understand what they have a problem about. They don't even understand the competitor's identity, and yet they have an opinion on it.
Are there any trans issues that you feel aren't being talked about?
I think that there's enough people talking about trans quote-unquote issues, but there's not enough people listening to trans people about what those issues actually are. You know, I know for myself, I don't fit neatly into a trans masculine box. And it's really easy, I think, for people who aren't trans to understand transness, if that's such a thing, as being born as one thing but wanting to be the quote-unquote opposite of whatever that thing is, and that it's just like it's not that simple and it's not that easy, and like I wish it was. I wish I could just do this thing and be the opposite of this thing. And then sometimes, you know, going through periods of really, and I'm just coming out of a period of really, really intense dysphoria where it's like I don't even want to leave the house. I don't want anyone to look at me, because what other people are seeing and the way that other people are interpreting me is not who I am, and it just like it takes such a toll. So I think like often being trans and being non-binary or being, you know, gender non-conforming is treated as in and of itself as being problematic, whereas understanding it's only problematic because of the culture that it exists in.
My name is Kate, and just a reminder that we are on Joy 94.9, in case you didn't know, and you're listening to This Australian Life. This week, we're talking with two really amazing guests. First off, we're in the middle of chatting with Roar about their experience as a trans and non-binary person. We get to see a little bit of their life as they journey forward, growing up in a family that wasn't always supportive, what it was like to come out of that and learn how to help others themselves. You spoke a little bit about how you don't exactly fit into the trans masculine label.
Mm.
Do you find that that's a problem for you with other trans people?
Oof, that's such a great question. Oof. It depends on where you go. There can be a lot of gatekeeping on Facebook and in other pockets of, I guess, the internet and trans groups. They're, you know, it's either pronounced, I think it's Truscum. I think that that's how it's pronounced. I've only ever seen it written. I've never actually heard it out loud, but I think that's the pronunciation. And so there's different schools of thoughts and there's like these different infights, in the sense that there are some trans people, groups of trans people that believe that unless you experience dysphoria and particularly bodily dysphoria, then you're not trans. And also if you're not taking steps towards transitioning, physically transitioning, then you're not trans. Physically transitioning is so inaccessible for so many people for a variety of reasons. It's really hard to physically transition in terms of all the services you need to access, all the approvals you need to get, the amount of money that it costs, depending on what kind of, you know, and that's just talking about HRT, let alone, you know, going in for surgeries or, you know, vocal training or any number of things that come along with taking steps towards that thing. I've experienced a lot of that kind of gatekeeping online, but my experience with actual trans people in real life that I've met and other trans friends that I have is not that at all. We all have a deep-seated fear of imposter, you know, that imposter syndrome. We all feel it very, very deeply. Maybe we're pretending this thing. And that put me off actually really exploring or making an effort to get to know any more trans people for so many years, because I was so terrified that I would be told that I wasn't this thing. And I'm like, I can deal with the rejection from everyone else, but if I'm rejected by the people that I feel like I'm supposed to be a part of, then where does that leave me?
Speaking a little bit about your life growing up, mm-hmm. What was it like?
There was some difficulty. There were some hard times. It certainly wasn't the easiest of times. I was a very, very anxious and very stressed child. I internalized everything. I experienced a lot of bullying. And from the age of 13, I felt really, really done with life. Like, I was really struggling. So I don't look back on my childhood with fondness, and not in the sense that it's necessarily anyone's fault. Like, there was, you know, hard stuff at home, which I don't really want to go into detail about necessarily on air, but it was kind of lower middle class and we struggled. Yeah, it was hard. I look back at my childhood and I'm like, not for all the money in the world would I do it again. I mean, I got pregnant when I was 27. My life was in turmoil. Oh my God, dysphoria and pregnancy, that was a ride. Then the words for what my gender was, I'd always felt this point of difference in terms of my gender, but I didn't. The only way that I'd heard it expressed was that if I wasn't a woman, then I must be a man, and neither of those things felt right to me. Even though I veered towards more of the masculine, but calling myself a man, I was always much happier calling myself a boy, and I still am. Like, I feel like boy suits me better, but man, I'm like, oh no, I don't resonate with that. And getting pregnant, which is like considered, I guess, one of the most feminine of things, and it was an accidental pregnancy. And experiencing this extreme dysphoria and not having any language for what that thing is, and trying to speak to, you know, medical professionals and other people about what this thing was that I was experiencing, and it just, them obviously not even having the language for it, and it just being quite dismissed, and it's like, oh no, you're fine, like, you're fine. And but I knew things weren't fine.
Did you speak with your partner, the father of your child, about this dysphoria you were feeling?
Oh God, no. Definitely not.
Why not? Basically, can you say if it was on you that you didn't say anything, or the other person?
I mean, it was definitely because of who they are. I mean, I'm still trying to have that conversation with them, because I mean, they're someone that is going to be in my life for the rest of my life, because I have a child with them. So, the rigid gender roles are strong in that one.
Knowing you personally, I know that you do a lot of work in trying to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
Especially women. Mm. Why is that, or has it always been a part of your life?
Yeah, I think it's I think it's always been a part of my life, or it's always been a part of like my internal programming, in the sense of that it's one of my core values is, you know, being of service. But there, there's a distinct line in my life. As much as I wanted to be of service and as much as I wanted to be useful, I wasn't able to because I was so destructive. My behaviours were so self-destructive, and I would, there was no capacity there for anyone else. And that caused me a lot of pain, because I could see the incongruency between the person that I wanted to be in my life, the way that I wanted to conduct myself, and my capacity for actually being able to conduct myself in that way. And there was such a big difference between those two things. And I always internalized that as a, because it was something fundamentally wrong with me, because I was wrong. Once I was able to get the help that I needed and to take the steps that I needed to disengage from really harmful behaviours, to be able to show up in the world in the ways that were meaningful to me, and to start working towards the goals that were important to me. Once I had the capacity to do that, it's changed, and the way that I'm able to be of service to people today, and the way that I am able to be useful in other people's lives is such a joy. And I never take it for granted, because I know what it's like to be on the other side of that thing. And the more that I continue to grow and do the personal work that I need to do, the more I can show up in these ways. And that makes me feel good about being here in a way that like I never had before, because this world is really, really tough. And it's tough, I think, for all of us. And, no one gets out of here untraumatized.
You're still listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9. We're talking with Christy Rohr, who prefers to go by Rohr, about some of the trans issues that are quite pertinent today. Rohr has worked for a number of organizations, nonprofits centered around trans rights. And they share with us our experience. Hope you enjoy. You've worked for trans organizations.
Yes.
Can you tell me about this video project you were involved in?
Yes, I worked for an organization that I was one of the scriptwriting team members, and wrote some short films for a family violence prevention project specifically targeted at trans and gender diverse people.
What was that process like, seeing your words up on screen and hearing trans actors saying what you'd written?
Look, I mean, I think as an artist, and I think as anybody who creates anything can understand, I hate watching anything that I've done. I hate watching anything I'm in. I want to do the work and get out. I mean, maybe some people don't. Maybe some people really enjoy seeing their work up and, celebrating its success. And, God, I wish I was one of those people. It wasn't necessarily so much seeing it up there. It was so wonderful that we had basically all trans actors. It's hard enough for trans folks to get jobs for acting roles that... it doesn't always just have to be about the fact that they're trans. And we had trans actors playing cisgender people, and so we flipped the script on that one, so that was exciting. But it was so great to get their feedback afterwards and how much it meant to them. And I think that was the biggest thing. It's like, at the end of the day, all the changes that on reflection I would go back and make, and all the refinement that I would make to it, it's like, that's just the perfectionist in me. Like, nothing is ever really finished. There's always room for improvement. But knowing how much it meant to the people who saw it, and that was the best part. It's like, it's what it means to the people who are viewing it, or the difference that it makes to them. And, being able to let that in and really hearing that, like, that's special.
Moving forward, do you think you'll be working in more organizations like this?
I don't ever see my career trajectory or my life trajectory is something that's quite, like, easily marked out. I'm trying to find a place where I can live as close as possible in line with my values, get paid for the work I do, that means that I can make some kind of difference in some kind of way. But how can I show up in meaningful ways in the communities that I do exist in? How can I help other people? How can I bring joy to the world? You know, because I think that that stuff really, really does matter. And if I spend too long worrying about all the things that I can't change, it doesn't take me long to get into a pit that I don't feel like I can get out of. So, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, we did it. That's all from Christy Rohr. This week, we're talking with Morgan, an ambulance driver and paramedic. Morgan is 31 years old, cisgendered female. She identifies as gay or lesbian. Today, we really get into her journey as someone who, trigger warning, has dealt with assault as being an ambulance driver and paramedic, but more importantly, someone who has faced the day-to-day challenges for nearly 10 years of getting up, working 4 days in a row, 14-hour shifts, to consistently be dealing with those who are confronting their own trauma and at the same time trying to sort out her own life. We hope you enjoy.
I never really thought of myself as doing something that I would require me sitting behind a desk all day. So I was trying to think of things that were an alternative. Firefighter popped up, police officer popped up, and paramedic popped up. I have asthma, so being a firefighter obviously would be quite a poor option there. And I like helping people, and the medical side and sciencey side of paramedicine certainly captivated me. I've been assaulted a couple of times. I mean, verbally assaulted, it's a daily thing. It happens all the time. You don't, in all fairness, you don't pay much attention to it. You may get threatened. A lot of the people that end up threatening us are drug affected or alcohol affected, and we will get police involved, particularly if we're not feeling safe. We'll get police involved quite quickly. Probably the two times that I've been really threatened were both medical calls. I wasn't expecting it. One of them, he just didn't like paramedics. He'd had some sort of poor interaction with paramedics previously, and when we turned up, he just started throwing punches at me, which was all very peculiar. So I ran away, as I did, and got my ambulance and I left and called the police. So that's always going to be my standpoint. And the other time was this kind of a similar case, but it was a medical call, and we went into his house and were chatting to him, and he was a little bit standoffish with me, but I thought that he might have been drug or alcohol affected because he was slurring his words and couldn't really stand up straight. So he walked down to the kitchen and I followed him. I wasn't feeling threatened at the time or anything like that, and I followed him down, and he grabbed a knife and turned around and came at me with a knife, which I was quite surprised about. I certainly didn't see that coming, and that pretty quickly escalated to, of course, me running out of the house and taking my partner and the other person with us and calling police, and he was subsequently had an interaction with police. So I've never been actually hurt in those sorts of instances, but that's because I will quite happily just run away. But yeah, it's not the ones that you expect for me. It has never been the ones that I've expected. So it has taught me to, even at the jobs where you don't think that they're going to be violent or aggressive, just to stay a bit more alert and to really have a good look around and see if there are any weapons. And, you know, if you think about a kitchen, we spend a lot of time in kitchens because people often sit in the kitchen or in the dining room, and you know, the way that we live these days in open plan houses, the kitchen and dining room are one and the same. So there's lots of knives, there's lots of pokey, spiky things in kitchens as a general. So it's always one of those things that you just think about a little bit, and you think about, you know, your positioning in the room. I'll position myself between the patient and the door so I can get to the door before they can. Make sure that where you put your equipment down, you can either pick up your equipment and push it between them, yourself and the patient if required, or, you know, try and make sure you know how many people are in the house and did you see that door open or closed on your way in, or those sorts of things, just so that you have a good understanding of how you can get in, how you can get out, and what might happen, which is a lot to think about when you're trying to figure out whether or not this person's having a heart attack and those sorts of things.
You said you get, like, assaulted verbally daily.
We deal a lot with people that are drug or alcohol affected, and in that instance, they don't care. Some people have bad reactions to, you know, to medications or whatever it is, and we turn up, they might not want us there. It might have been a family member that called us, so they might not want to be involved with us. It is much more frequent than people would think, depending on where you're working and, you know, what day it is and those sorts of things as well. Like, if it's a busy Friday night in the city, you're going to be dealing with people that aren't necessarily that thrilled to have you trying to take care of them. As a general, you would try to assume that people are honest and are good and that they're not out to get you. This job will change that a little bit, I have to say. I don't know why some people don't like ambos. We use so many acronyms. So acronyms for everything.
Do you call, like, do you talk about stuff in front of patients and you have, like, a something you would say?
Not really. We certainly, if we're with patients, we will, you know, we're probably the only thing that in that instance would be if we're feeling threatened and we don't want them to know that we're feeling threatened, you know, so you could say we, you know, might have a little bit of a Cody thing, or might request a specific piece of equipment from the ambulance, which means I want you to leave the house and I don't want you to come back in and I'm going to come straight back out, but can you go out and, you know, organise police? But, you know, I've seen something that's really threatening or whatever it is, so that they know that you've seen something, so they're not just like, blah, 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 off oblivious, you know, writing down medications or whatever it is.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. We're going to have a few messages, and we'll still be here. Hi, my name is Kate. You're listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9. We're still talking with Morgan about what it is like being an ambulance driver. Is it as exciting as you think? Maybe. But most importantly, we'll get inside her own journey of dealing with the systems of being a paramedic driver. Things you wouldn't think about, like how if you've been assaulted once, that might be something that doesn't leave you, and you're always thinking, what could happen? What's the worst that could happen? Hope you enjoy. Heard about this story where there was this big asthma storm or something in Victoria.
Well, interestingly, one wasn't actually working that night. It was a phenomenally busy night within ambulance, and it was unprecedented numbers of calls to help the public. And there's actually been an inquest into how it was managed and what happened with that. But we'd never really experienced anything like that before. Interestingly, me, myself, as an asthmatic, I was very minimally affected. It actually caught a lot of people who don't have a diagnosed asthma history off guard because they have they essentially had the symptoms of asthma and they had an asthmatic type reaction. However, they didn't ever consider themselves to be asthmatic, so they didn't really know what was going on.
Was that traumatic for other members, say, that you knew, other paramedics?
Within Ambulance Victoria, there's a few levels of paramedic. So most of our service are advanced life support paramedics. So probably about 80% are advanced life support paramedics. Each member and each, you know, qualification within the organisation play an absolutely critical role. But for something like asthma, in the critically unwell asthmatic, having access to intensive care paramedics as well as advanced life support paramedics can be required, not always, but in the critically unwell patients and cohort, certainly having intensive care is a very good thing. So the people that are advanced life support were finding on that night that it was difficult to, because so many people were so unwell, so unexpectedly unwell, they felt like there was more that they would have liked to have done but weren't necessarily trained to do as advanced life support. That, I think, certainly didn't make them feel very good, but that's something that we, as, you know, a group of people may always struggle with a little bit, no matter what your qualification is, because there's always going to be times when I wish I could have done more for someone, but I'm not a doctor, you know, I'm not a trauma surgeon, and I'm unfortunately not a miracle worker. So no matter what I would have liked to have done, I can't necessarily do it. I think the biggest mistake that I made as a paramedic, and I think a lot of paramedics would make, is being too hard on yourself. To start with, you are going to make mistakes. There's no two ways about it. Everyone makes mistakes in life and in their job, and, you know, this is a job, and so you will make mistakes, but learn from them. Do your best to learn from your mistakes, and don't spend forever beating yourself up about it. Figure out the best way to move on from it and to learn from it, because I'm, you know, as a not so new paramedic at the moment, still learning a lot from my mistakes and from my experiences.
We have Morgan, an ambulance driver, paramedic, who lives and works in Melbourne. We'll hear about some of the amazing issues that affect ambulance drivers, ones you might not have considered before. Like, what is it to be sitting next to someone for most of the day that before, maybe a week ago, you never even talked to before?
I'll speak to my roster, which is fairly standard across Ambulance Victoria and most paramedic services. So I work at what is called a 10-14 roster. So I do two 10-hour day shifts, and then I do two 14-hour night shifts consecutively. So I'll do day, night, night. And then I have 4 days off. So I work on an 8-day rotating roster. I don't mind shift work. A lot of people do. You just kind of make it work for you is the way that I've always looked at it. And if it doesn't work for you overall, then maybe this isn't the job for you, unfortunately, because it's a 24-hour service we have to provide. It's really hard on your friendships and your family, and it can become quite isolating. It is really hard. You miss a lot of birthdays, you miss a lot of Christmases, you miss a lot of special events. I'm working Christmas Day this Christmas, you know, so I won't see my family at all around Christmas. I'll see them probably a couple of days before, and then they'll go away and I'll work Christmas, and I'll be lucky to see anyone overly important to me on Christmas Day. But, you know, I'll get a feed at work, so that's okay. I think one of the things that you end up finding after being in the job for a few years is a lot of your friendships that you had pre-coming to the job might have kind of faded away a little bit because you stopped getting invited to things. So you become friends with ambos. The hard bit thing about that is trying to get your rosters to line up so you can actually catch up. And, you know, someone's working a night shift today, then I'm working a day shift tomorrow, and the other one's working in the afternoon, and you go, great, I'll see you guys in 6 weeks' time. No worries.
As a paramedic, you talked about having a partner. How does that work?
Your partner changes pretty much every month, maybe once every 2 months, depends on the rostering. You are both qualified essentially to the same level in terms of I'll drive all shift and my partner will treat patients all shift. In the event that you have a critically unwell patient that needs two people to be actively treating them, then we will often get another crew and that crew will drive us. you get to know the person that you're working with for a month really well because you spend a lot of time with them. As a general, I'd see my work partner more than I'd see my home partner for the month. So, which is, you know, if you think about how much time you spend at work, kind of normal, except for you spend it almost all of it with one person and sitting next to them for really long stretches of time. And most of the time, yeah, you get on pretty well as well.
But what if you don't?
You just kind of learn to manage it. You go, oh, well, as long as it's, you know, nothing really specific in the intensive care realm, there it's certainly changing. It used to be very male-dominated. And so as a relatively young female, especially a relatively young gay female, it's one of those things that you go, oh, are we going to get on or is this going to be a super awkward month? Your kids are my age. Sport's good. And sometimes you just have prolonged periods of silence and you turn the radio up a little bit. The hardest thing is figuring out what radio station to listen to.
What is the ratio of male to female?
Ambulance has now moved into ambulance as a general. It's actually more female dominant now. Our recruitment, we've had a huge amount of females applying, which is fantastic. And that's happened over the last, probably the last 10 to 15 years. So women have only been in ambulance. We celebrated our 30 years of women in ambulance 2 years ago, I think it was. So it's still relatively new, which is upsetting, but we're obviously changing that. The area that I work in and the branch that I work at, considered a younger intensive care branch, so 30s is probably our average age. However, you know, the average age of Mica, I would suspect, would be around 50.
Would you say there are more gay women, like, as opposed to, like, straight
as
women?
I wouldn't think there was more gay women than straight women. I think uniform jobs tend to attract one. Well, I think it's, you know, attractive. There do tend to be, I would have thought, a high proportion within the emergency services than within the general population, but I don't actually know that. Ambulance is actually, I think, quite a safe space to be gay or LGBTI.
I assume the ratio of gay men in AMBO work versus gay women is probably much higher.
Which way? I'm not sure.
Really?
No, I'm not. There are quite a lot of gay men within ambulance and there are quite a lot of gay women as well, but I wouldn't be able to tell you which was higher. And, you know, part of that might be that, one, people, you know, don't necessarily walk up to me and be like, hey, you're Morgs, right? Yeah, oh, I'm so-and-so and I'm gay. Oh, yeah, no worries. Cool.
We spoke before about how you're really passionate about unions.
Oh, look, I'm very pro-union and I'm pro workers' rights and keeping your employer in line. Pleasure to be here. Wow. One of the changes that we've been through is we went through a work value case with through the Fair Work Commission. Look, what we were looking for was recognition and a monetary recognition of the increase in the difficulty of our job over the past about 10 years. Because there's been a lot of clinical changes, like hundreds of clinical changes. And, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you didn't need a degree to be a paramedic. You didn't need to go to university. It was essentially an on-road traineeship, kind of like an apprenticeship. And the, you know, the area has changed a lot in the last 20 years. And so now you won't get into ambulance without a degree. You have to have a degree in paramedical science, so not just in some unrelated field, because it's quite specific, which is good and bad. So we went through Fair Work as part of our EBA negotiations, essentially, which became very stalled. It was incredibly difficult and demoralizing, and it was not very fun to be at work while we were having these stalled negotiations and to feel like we just weren't worth it. It was one of those things that made it hard to come to work and made it hard to, you know, think of this as a career that was going to have a future. We had a mediator, essentially, and from that we got a significant pay increase. It took us almost 3 years, and it was really unpleasant and none of us liked it, but we wouldn't have got any of that without our union had we continued to go the way we were our attrition rate and people leaving ambulance was, the numbers were astronomical. Couldn't see a future within ambulance. So now it's much, much better. It's hugely improved.
Thank you for listening. That is all the time that we have for this week. You're listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9. This is my last week hosting, or this show being on air, for a few months at least. And I can't say enough about how much I've enjoyed being a part of this community and this program. Another thing I'd like to mention is that almost all of our guests, except for one, have been LGBTIQ+. And I think it's so important to be listening to these stories, to listen to our voices, and to know what a rich tapestry of a life everyone lives. But we just deserve to be on air because it's Joy. Thanks so much. Hope you have a wonderful evening. My name's Kate.
Yeah.